time to unleash your inner cowboy with the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Now, here's your host, Alyssa Barnes.
Hello, Earn Your Spurs listeners. Welcome to episode 14 of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Today, I'm excited to introduce you to one of my fellow podcasters, John Herrer. John hosts a podcast called The Whoa Podcast, all about horses. So if you're an avid podcast listener and a horse enthusiast, I would definitely recommend you check out John's podcast. Now, John is not your typical horseman. He had a little bit of experience with horses early on and didn't get that involved with them until much later in life. In fact, his wife had a horse for 25 years and all he knew was how to feed and water it. It wasn't until his wife actually bought her second horse and he got started watching clinicians like Clinton Anderson on RFD TV that he got interested enough in horses to get one of his own. So today we're going to talk about how John got into horses in the first place, how he learned the basics of horsemanship through watching clinicians like Clinton Anderson on RFD, and basically just his journey into horses. So for anyone who's interested in buying their first horse, this is probably going to be a really helpful episode for you because John shares a lot about the mistakes he made along the way and what recommendations he would have for other people based on the experiences he's had himself. And being a podcaster himself, John felt a little strange being on the other side of the microphone, so he asked me a few questions as well. I know you don't hear me talking a whole lot in most of the episodes because I like to give the guests the spotlight, but I do share a little bit more information in this one than is typical. So I hope you get a lot of value out of this episode, and without further ado, let's go ahead and talk to John. John, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Alyssa.
Yeah, I'm super excited to have you on. I would love for you to tell us just all about your background and kind of how you eventually got into horses.
Well, I really love your show. First, let me say just say that first. You've been only have 12 episodes, but they've really been very informational and entertaining. I really like that. In just 12 episodes, you've I like your podcast almost better than mine, actually.
Oh. Well, thank you, John. I really appreciate that compliment, and I love your podcast as well. So,
well, thanks. And you know, a lot of people get into horses. They were put on the back of a horse when they were three or four, and then they live their life around horses. And I've got some really early pictures of me on a pony, but it was one where you were strapped into the saddle and the horse was in one of those almost like a hot walker thing and just kind of rode around, and it was a more of a photo opportunity. But I've really always loved animals, and it didn't matter if it was a dog or a frog or a horse. I just really loved that connection that you could make a friend with something that wasn't human, that couldn't speak to you. And I'd always had a dog or some sort of animal. And somewhere around my adolescence, the sixth, seventh grade area, we moved around a lot. And it wasn't anything they were building a lot of schools. There was a lot of different things going on. And I got transferred from school to school. And I'd lost a lot of the friends that I'd grown up with. And I didn't handle it particularly well. I just didn't want to make too many friends anymore. I still had some friends, but not a lot. And we moved up to Bakersfield. And part of my father and my mother's upbringing is that you had to have a job. So I got a paper route. I worked a paper route. It was Sunday, Wednesday deliveries, and it didn't earn me much money, but it earned me about $10, $12 a month. And there was this stable about 2 miles away from our house. Now, I was 12 or 13, and this was the 60s, the 1960s, not the 1860s, but It was a long time ago, and I would – and at, in those days, people could actually let their children go for the day in the summertime, and I would ride down to the stables. It was a couple miles away, and I'd take my earnings, and I'd go to this guy. I had the old stable – this old guy at the stables, and I'd say, hey, I want to rent a horse. And he says, do you know how to ride? And I said, of course I know how to ride. Yeah, you know, I watch Westerns. There's this cocky little 12 or 13 year old. Of course I know how to ride. He says, okay. He says, I'm going to rent you a horse. He says, it's $5 or $6 an hour. It's all, like almost half my monthly salary. And I said, but I really wanted to ride a horse. And he says, I got two instructions for you. He says, don't let him run back to the barn, and don't, whatever you do, don't bring him back sweaty. So I said, sure, no problem, buddy, and saddle me up the horse. So he saddles up this horse, and if you can believe it, I'm riding along the Kern River in amongst the oil fields, 13, no supervision, nobody around. The guy lets me take his horse out. It's kind of lightly forested area, and these were just some really great days. And I would meander around, and of course, this is going to be a theme. You'll find out. I call it thrifty. My friends sometimes call it cheap, but I was paying for 60 minutes, and so I was going to use every one of those 60 minutes that I could. So we wandered around, and I turned the I got to get back. Lose myself. I got to get back to the barn. So we he'll never know. We trot a little bit. Well, these horses are pretty barn sour. And he just kind of takes me almost all the way back to the barn at a lope. I stop him about a quarter mile away, and we walk back in just as calm as could be. But it's the horse is all sweaty. So I just get my tail chewed up and down. You weren't supposed to bring this horse back sweaty. Blah, 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 blah. And he goes on and on. And then I said, "Well, listen, sir, I can do anything you want. I wanted to help around the barn. I'll wash him, I'll dry him, I'll brush him, whatever you want me to do. No, kid, get out of here." So I said, "Well, okay," and I go back. And 2 weeks later, I'm back again. So he wasn't so upset that he wouldn't take my $5 or $6 for the hour. But again, the second time, he tells me, "You know, listen, I want you to bring this horse back sweaty." So I said, "Oh, don't worry, I won't." Well, you know, it's Bakersfield in California, and in the summer times, back in the 60s, it didn't take the sun much work at all to get it up to be 100 degrees. So I'd bring the horse back sweaty, yeah. And he'd yell at me. And this went on for most of that summer. And finally, I kind of got tired of being yelled at because I didn't really know much about horses. I mean, I kicked them to go and pulled them to stop. And I didn't know how to make the horse not sweat. So that was it. I mean, I that was my experience with horses. I started working for a veterinarian in high school, and my attention turned to dogs and cats. And I spent 7 years as a veterinary technician. I was one of the first licensed technicians in California. I worked at an emergency clinic, so I got to do a lot of the surgeries and the testing, the blood tests, and the radiology and things like that. So I really had a good foundation in animals and knew what they were about. And then I married a horse lover. And Renee and I have been married for over 30 years now, and she had always wanted a horse when she became an adult. So before we got married, she contracted with one of our friends who was in the horses and bought this horse as it was still in the mare, actually. And then when it dropped, they kept it for a until it was weaned, and then we brought it to our – we have a little half acre here in Bakersfield, and I didn't even have the pens, and I didn't know too much about horses. My veterinary experience had only exposed me to horses a couple of times, and I just could not figure out how to handle them like I could a dog or a cat. I couldn't figure out how do you restrain this 1,200-pound animal to give it medicine or treat a wound. And I just really didn't understand anything about them. And she rode this horse. Of course, she didn't know much about horse training per se. And she she came off a couple of times, and I saw her come off a couple of times, and you know, it was very painful experiences, and I really couldn't talk her out of being around horses. So I went off and I did other things. I took up golf and mountain biking and different things of that nature. We kept that horse for 25 years, and he was a good horse. He was a thoroughbred cross, and he finally passed away, and she got herself a brand new horse. She went out and she'd been saving her money. We kind of knew the old horse was going for a while, and she had saved up for this very well-trained horse. Well, she owned it for a week, and he was a very well-trained horse in an arena. But when we trail ride, we usually trail ride out around our neighborhood, and there are dogs and plastic bags and fences. And she came off the very first week, and she tweaked her back. And I told her, honey, I said, you got to stay off this horse for a couple of weeks. She says, my horse is really well trained. How am I going to, he needs exercise. I said, don't worry, I'll ride him. This little 12, 13-year-old cocky kid, I think, came up again. And, and it had been about this time that RFD started airing the TV trainer shows, the Clinton Anderson, Craig Cameron, Ken McNabb shows. And I had been following along those and was starting – the fire was starting to burn that, hey, I had just been talking to these horses the wrong way. I'd been trying to communicate with them like a dog or a cat, and they just don't respond well to that, as you know. Anyway, to make a long story short, I started riding her horse. She was off for about 3 weeks as her back started to heal, and I did a lot of groundwork with that horse. I did I also just started riding him on, trotting him, long trotting him, and doing some stuff. And she started getting better. Our neighbors, who are very good friends with us, they had just gotten a horse, and we went up for a trail ride. I wasn't going to do any horse stuff. I had the dogs, and I was going to ride my mountain bike someplace other than they were going to ride. And as our neighbor was getting on her horse, she tweaked her knee. And she actually cracked her kneecap, and she said she was going to be laid up for 8 weeks. She said, John, if you want to work Charlie, go ahead. So I had a whole new horse. I said, I can do anything with him. You can do anything you want with him. So I called up Clinton Anderson, and I got his stick and string, and I got his rope halter, and my wife fell over when I went out and bought a cowboy hat, so I looked the part. and every morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, I'd go out there and I started on the Clinton Anderson program of groundwork first, and every 6 days a week I was out there working Charlie, and we really developed a pretty strong bond. I got him to do a number of different things, and 8 weeks came up, and Susan said, I want my horse back. I said, okay, that's fine. And what really sealed the deal, what really made me want to get a horse, was the little story I'm going to tell you next, is that the girls, Susan and my wife, and then a couple of their friends, every year they go on their birthday trip. They all have birthdays in March, and they'll pick some place that they go to. They've been to New Orleans, Chicago. It just has been a number of different places. Every year they pick something. So they're gone for 4 or 5 days. And I'm left behind, and I take care of the horses and do all that stuff. And I'm still watching these TV programs. And Ken McNabb comes on a Friday night. I'm watching TV, and he says, I got a mounting block exercise. And he shows it. I watch it on the show, and I'm working Saturdays mornings at this point in my life, and I can't wait. It's dark, so I can't do anything that night. I can't wait to get home the next day. So I get home 1 o'clock, and I start teaching Dusty, my wife's horse, this mounting block exercise. And I'm not kidding you, Alyssa. 20 minutes, this horse is picking me up off the fence, picking me up off of the mounting block. I move over to a bale of hay, picking me up off a bale of hay. And I'm just like, wow, if you do the things in a right way, the horse picks it up really easily. So I not only teach him, but I teach Susan's horse, Charlie. Then Susan has another horse. So I teach that horse. I get, you know, I'm running out of horses. I'm asking my other neighbor, hey, can I teach your horse how to do a mounting block? Well, little did I, you know, not being a cowboy, sometimes at that point in our lives, people thought mounting blocks were kind of sissy devices, you know? You should be able to get up on your own darn horse, for crying out loud. You shouldn't have to get a mounting block. And the girls were coming back Sunday night, and I mean, I couldn't wait to tell them. I was like a kid at Christmas. You know, Susan had a bum knee. Renee was still recovering from her back. This was going to be the perfect thing for these guys. I was going to show them exactly how much I knew and be vindicated for, you know, my horse knowledge. And they get back from I pick them up at the airport, and I'm driving them home, and they're telling me about their trip, and I can hardly sit still, and I just want to tell them about this mounting block. And I tell them, I said, hey, you know, I taught the horses something while you guys were gone. And they'd only been gone for like 4 days. And they're like, oh, yeah, well, what did you teach them? I said, I taught them this mounting block exercise. And it was like, yeah, good job, John. So this was the Sunday night, so it was all week before – it was wintertime. So it was all week before we get to a chance to see the horses again. So Saturday comes along, and I get out Dusty, and I give him the old cue to come to the mounting block. And Renee says, oh, that looks pretty nice. I said, no, you got to try it. You got to try it. So she gets up on the mounting block, and – when she stepped over that horse from standing on the mounting block, you could just see it was so much easier for her. And the smile came across her face, and I felt very proud and full of myself. And that's when I said, you know, I got to get a horse of my own because this stuff is starting to work. And that's essentially how I got into horses. And then I bought a horse, and we just started riding together, and it was a lot of fun.
So it was sort of the being able to communicate and teach them something that really got you interested.
Yes. And it was that feedback, you know, when you give a horse a cue and he answers that cue with the response you wanted, it's just an incredible feedback mechanism for you. And up until that point, you know, we had had a horse that we had kept on our property for a little bit, and we wanted to get it in a trailer. Well, this horse was just not trailer loading for nothing. And, you know, we tried the rough method. We tried the, you know, give them some carrot method. Nothing worked. And it was all because we were just doing it wrong. We just didn't know how to talk to them in the language they understand.
So then you went out and bought your own horse. What did you end up getting?
Well, the first horse I got, like many horse owners, I've got kind of a linear mind. So I looked at all the research and said, get a vet check, ride the horse and do all that stuff. And I did. I didn't ride as many horses as I should have, looking back on it. But I found a horse that I thought was a really good horse and bought him. His name was Tex. He was a registered quarter horse gelding, about the 7 year range, and took him through Clinton Anderson method, and he did superb. He did everything I asked him to do. He was a solid horse, but I ride a lot, and I ride, we trail ride a lot, and I like going down the trail, and I'll put my iPod on and put the music on, and we'll just take off, and it'll be a couple hours. Well, the guy who sold them to me was a little bit less than ethical, and that horse had naviculars. So about 8 months into it, it started showing up, and I'd give him a month off, didn't know what was going on. I gave him a month off, came back, he was still bad. And finally, after owning him a year, I took him, had him evaluated. Vet said, you should have never bought this horse. And I said, yeah, okay. It didn't show up on the pre-vet check, but we didn't do x-rays. We did all the other pressure tests and stuff. So I did what was right for Tex, and I went out looking for another horse. And I ended up with my mare, Jessie. Jessie is a 7-year-old foundation quarter horse when I got her. I liked the fact that she hadn't been worked really hard. She had 60 days training on her when I got her, and she had had two babies. So to me, that said she had sit around the stalls for a while and just made babies, and she wasn't going to have the navicular problem anyway that Tex had had. And she went through the program incredibly well. I learned a lot from both of the horses as I went through, and she's just as, you know, solid as Sear. She can trail ride with the best of them. She's a little bit herd bound in some situations, but she's solid. She's carried me a long ways, and one of the things that impressed me as I was going through my horsemanship education was the Road to the Horse in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I got Clinton's video of that, his first time through, and he had a chainsaw that he would kind of wave around his horse. And we got a half an acre, I got a couple of trees, and I'm chainsawing this, and I'm looking at Jesse in the stall, and I'm chainsawing this tree, and I go, I wonder if she'll stand there while I wave this chainsaw around. And Clinton's had his without the chain. I just locked my bar so the chain wouldn't turn around, and went in that stall, and she was as desensitized as could be. That didn't bother her at all. And then I said, well, I got to share this with people. I started videotaping it, and then I started a little YouTube channel with our training techniques, and I really wanted to share some of the stuff I was learning, because I looked back at our first horse, which I don't think I told you his name was Vandy, and all the mistakes we made. If we would have been better horsemen, that horse would have had a better life. And both Renee and I felt guilty that we came to this knowledge so late that we didn't really do fair by Vandy. We didn't really give him the tools that he needed to cope with the life that he was, you know, that he was living. And he was a good horse. She could trail ride with him from time to time, but, you know, she couldn't maximize his potential. And we feel now that with a little bit of horse knowledge that we do know, that we're at least able to help our horses in situations where they need it most.
When you say that you took your two horses through the Clinton Anderson method, did you watch the videos and just apply what you learned, or what did that look like?
I'm a very linear guy, and a lot of people, my friends included, it kind of scoffed at the fact that I bought his DVD series, and in that series, he has specific exercises that you go in a specific order, and I did it. I mean, I didn't go to the next one until I finished the first one, and I went through that procedure, and we had sent Vandy to the, just to go back a little bit, we had sent Vandy to the trainer for a couple of months to be broken, and when he came back, he was good for the first days, but because we didn't have the tools to follow up, he kind of went back to his old ways. Well, with the DVDs, I mean, I spent about $600 for the entire DVD. It was a little bit less expensive than it is now. I think it's better now than when I got it. But there was 3 Riding with Confidence series and 3 Gaining Respect on the Ground series. Is that every time I ran into a problem, I could put the horse up, go inside, watch the DVD again, see how he did it, come back outside, and almost invariably I was doing something not quite right and went back, watched it, came back out, did it again. It would come out right. Then I could go on to the next step. Mm-hmm. So it was essentially, you know, kind of a paint by numbers type thing if I were an artist, but it was working. So and the knowledge and the confidence that I gained by doing it myself carried on to a lot of situations where we may have gotten in trouble. For example, we were riding through a field and the agricultural machinery was there and it went off. We didn't know. It was time to go off at a certain interval and we were riding right next to it, and this diesel motor came on and scared the holy crap out of both of us. And she shied But she took two steps and stopped and said, what are we going to do about this? And to me, that was worth every bit of, I mean, she didn't buck, she didn't bolt, she didn't do any of that stuff. And because I had had the tools, it just increased my confidence tremendously.
That's interesting. Do you think that anybody can learn the way that you did, or do you think it sort of takes a specific learning style to be able to watch that and apply it in that way?
That's an excellent question, because I've talked to people who have – I did some volunteer work for Equine Affair in Pomona, and I was down there for 4 or 5 years. And I volunteered at Clinton Anderson's walkabout tour 4 times. He doesn't take volunteers now, but you get to work behind the scenes. And I would always be talking to people about what they were getting and how they were getting. And some people would go to series 2 figuring they knew all the stuff in series 1, you know, that they weren't that stupid. So people didn't want to start at the beginning. And I think that those people that have that attitude aren't going to do very well with it. That if you're going to commit to doing something like that, and I don't really care if it's – I tell my listeners when we do the podcast that I don't really – doesn't matter to me which trainer you use. You should have a program for what you want to do. If you haven't grown up around horses all your life and you don't have that second nature knowledge. I mean, I was coming in 2004, I knew nothing about horses other than how to feed and take care of them. In 2005, I had my own horse. So there was a big gap in knowledge that I needed to absorb and digest very quickly. And Clinton's style, I listened to a lot of the different trainers, and Clinton's style appealed to me the most at that time. Now, since that time, I do go out to other trainers. I've done some cutting trainers. There's a very good trainer, Matt Sheridan, in Tehachapi. I've gone to a couple of his trail courses, and I pick up things from other trainers. But now I have a foundation to lay that stuff on top of. And it really helps me out. If I would have gone to those trainers first and taken a little bit of this trainer and a little bit of that trainer, I think I would have been far more confused in the long run.
So when you were first, you know, getting into horses and looking to buy your first horse, did you have any help from people near you, or did you kind of do that all on your own?
It's one of the things that kind of got me into to doing the podcast is that I knew very few horse people. We don't have our horses at a barn. We're not seeing a lot of people with horses. And every time you go to ask somebody, it's going to cost you some money. And again, I'm thrifty, probably to a point of being silly about it in some respects, but I think if I can get this information on my own, I'll be better off. Well, obviously, in the first instance with text, that kind of bit me in the butt, and I knew I needed to be around more horse people, and that's what kind of led me to podcasting, is because that no one wanted to talk to John Hare, the guy who owned a quarter horse and didn't know what he was doing. But if I could offer somebody some free publicity, or tell them to, you know, help me educate the public, then the door started opening. And to answer your question, I didn't really have anybody to help me out other than the vet check. And that turned out to be, unless I wanted to go all the way and have x-rays done, that wasn't going to change the situation much.
Right. But now that you've had horses for a while and you kind of went through all the video training, do you do a lot of hands-on clinics? And I know you said you've ridden with some different trainers. Is that something that you do a lot of now?
I would like to do more of it. I don't. I've done a couple of 3-day clinics with Matt Sheridan, and most everything we do now is usually by the hour, and a group of people go out. We started ranch sorting, so we found a ranch sorting trainer and did that. And we did the podcast took us up to Northern California to the Bar SZ Ranch, which is the home of the old Doc Bar Ranch. And they've turned that into a horse retreat now. And it's a great getaway. Those guys, Tim and Michelle Borland, who own that place, do a really good job. You can go up and ride on the 600 acres up there. And on the weekend we were there, we got to do some roping. He brought in a roper. We got to play with roping some cattle and the dummy and stuff, which I need a little bit more work on. And then we did some ranch sorting as well, too, in a kind of a very relaxed but very nice environment up there. So those types of things really thrill the heck out of me. And I really like doing covering for the podcast anyway. I like covering events. And just earlier in October, I covered the Vaquero Heritage Trainers Challenge, where they took 10 wild horses and they broke them. They had one horse that they had for 4 months that they got to show off, and then they had another younger horse that they got to break, or gentle, I should say, within 3 days. And that was a fun event to cover. I didn't get to ride. I would have liked to have spent some time on horseback. Those weekends where I'm covering something like that and not getting to ride, really, I've got to figure out a way to solve that situation. I did the same with Horseman's Reunion in Paso Robles. That was a week-long event, and I went over there a couple of days at a time to cover that event. Those people are really great. And but again, when I'm doing that stuff, I'm away from my horse, and I'd much rather spend the time in the saddle, or if I can.
Yeah. You need to just that, you know, the lady that does the interviews horseback during the Kentucky Derby, you just need to get your wireless mic and
there you go. That's right.
Although I don't know how well some of the material would translate into audio if, you know, they're demonstrating how to do something on a horse.
One of our first podcasts we did, we went to the Ojai Valley training, what was it? Ojai Valley Stables, and it's in Ojai, California. And I asked the owner, I said, hey, would you mind if we recorded some stuff? And she says, no, not at all. Go ahead. And we rented some horses to ride back in the Valley of Ojai, which is just this gorgeous area. Everything's lush and green, trees, canopies. It was a wonderful place to ride. And I'm holding this mic, my portable tape recorder out to this guy's mouth, and you know, but you can hear through me saddle squeaks and stirrups and horses snorting, and that was a tough one to edit.
Yeah, but that just makes it more authentic,
doesn't like it? Though
there,
that's what I thought.
So I know you mentioned that you like to do a lot of trail riding, and you've tried some ranch sorting and some roping. Is there any specific discipline that you're sort of following now, trying to get, you know, more into, or anything that you would like to try?
I'd really like to explore working equitation. I think it combines some of the aspects of reining and just doing things on horseback, getting your horse to do stuff. Reining, I feel, is a little bit too intense. I don't have the I'm 60 now. Some things you have to look ahead. I'm not letting anything stop me, don't get me wrong. But I look ahead and I say, how good can I be at this in the time that I have to spend with it now? And I try to be very realistic with my expectations. And reining seems to take a lot of time, and you have to have a lot of horse. And I'm not one to change horses a lot. I've got Jessie, she's mine. I'll keep her for a while, and if she becomes, you know, if I want to really compete, then I'll have to come to that bridge when I cross it. But it's not like we're going to be one of those guys that are always looking for the new prospect. Jessie's a good horse, doing what I want her to do, so I'll stick with her and then try and find a discipline that she can excel in. Trail riding, she's great. And then the trail classes that we've done with obstacles and stuff like that, she's done really well. So we may even explore more of that. But I'm trying to advance my horsemanship by taking her out of the snaffle, moving her into the bridle and seeing what I can do with that. And I'll tell you, one of the things that's really you kind of go as far as you can, and then you see something farther that you want to try. And one of the things, as I entered the horsemanship stuff, it was first I have to know how to communicate to the horse, and then I have to get my horse better. That was kind of my focus. And it wasn't very long before I started saying, well, wait a minute, my horse is doing good. Maybe it's the rider. You know, it's not what's the old saying? It's not the arrow, it's the Indian. Well, maybe it's the rider. So I started working on my riding skills, and that's where Renee helps me very, very much. She's a good rider, and she can spot things. We have this policy when we go riding that we can say anything to each other while we're on horseback, and no one can take offense. So she yells at me to bring my elbows in. Then I bring my elbows in, and I don't say, hey, what are you talking about? that's done. And then we make a pretty good team that way. So I've been trying to improve my riding skills as well.
I think that is a fantastic rule. I might have to implement that around here.
Because I'll tell her stuff to do on her horse that is, you know, she will still have some problems with telling Dusty exactly what she wants. And I'll see those things, and I can tell her those, and she can't get mad at me. And she can tell me about my riding, and I can't get mad at her.
Yeah. Well, I always tell the kids that, you know, if their horse isn't doing what they want it to do, it's because they're not asking it properly.
There you go.
They get mad when they're riding my old 19-year-old gelding who definitely knows how to do what they want him to do. But, you know, so I know that they get frustrated if they're not getting the results they think they want. But I always tell them, you know, if something's not going right, it's because you're not asking right. So, yeah, you can't get mad at him. He's just doing what you're telling him to do. So, well, that's very cool. I think it's a lot of fun to get involved in various disciplines and try different things and kind of see what fits for you.
And it really has been a great exploration. And one of the aspects about horsemanship and just connecting with animals has always been important to me. The one thing I didn't realize when I connected with horses is how much horsemanship and relating to horses really help your everyday life. You know, what you know as well as I, that if you're going to be around horses and you first have to have the mindset of a trainer, because the horse is always going to try and either push into your space or change stuff. I mean, the horses are just that way. And you have to control your emotions. So it really helps you in life. You know, you can't get angry at a horse and expect it to do something. Anger is just a sign that you've run out of knowledge. And in life, if you find yourself getting angry, it's just because you haven't learned enough yet. And then the other thing I like about horsemanship is that no matter what bad way I was trying to train a horse today, tomorrow, if I start the right way, it's going to get better. And that's something to keep in mind too in life as well, is that, you know, no matter how bad today is, if you can start tomorrow fresh and you start doing things the right way, then things are going to start falling into place exactly the way you want to. And those are two points that I really like about that I've learned about horses, being around horses, and they kind of strengthen those characteristics in myself. And that's what I like seeing.
Yeah. And I like how you said that if you're going to have a horse, you have to have the mindset of a trainer, because I think a lot of times people just want to ride and they don't want to have to really do anything else. But when you have, it's just like raising a child or a dog or whatever, you have to give them boundaries if you want the relationship to work. And, you know, you can't just sit up there and expect your horse to always do the right thing and take care of you. I mean, once in a while, I guess you get an old veteran and you get lucky. But I like what you said about always having that mindset, because, you know, you do have to learn how to communicate with your horse in order to have a good relationship with them.
And how long did it take? I mean, you grew up around horses. How long did it take you to learn that concept?
Well, it didn't take me very long because my dad's a horse trainer. So we were,
you lucky girl.
Well, it was from when we first started riding, my brother and I, it was always about training and it was always about correction. And so that was drilled into us from the very, very beginning when we first started riding. And you know, my dad, you could say that my dad has a little bit of that thrifty quality as well.
I like him.
And he, you know, he's not going to go out and spend 20, 30 grand on a horse. So if we wanted to have a nice horse to ride, he was going to buy us a cheap one and we had to make it into something that we liked.
Oh,
so, so that was, you know, always drilled into us our whole lives. And it makes you appreciate what you have. And when you do have a nice horse, you want to take care of it. Because believe me, not all of the horses that we rode were nice ones. But we certainly did have some great horses. We just rode a lot of different ones. So there were the ones that you were excited to get up and ride every day and the ones that you weren't.
Which ones did you learn the most from?
Well, probably those ones, you know, because I guess when you have my dad always says a really good horse will basically train itself. You know, you don't have to do a whole lot when you have a horse that's just got a great mind and just they're easy. They're easy to train and they always do what you ask. And it's the horses that are harder that teach you more because you have to figure out how to get through to them and it's not as easy.
And do you think that somebody like me who has just one horse, I mean, Renee and I switch off because we feel there's a value in riding other horses. But somebody like us, where we're limited to the number of horses we ride, we don't get to ride 10 horses a day or 10 horses even a week, you know, how much more difficult it is to learn about horsemanship that way?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess it's difficult because you're not facing as many different types of challenges and personalities and all that. But by only focusing on one horse, you're getting to know them really, really well, you know. So that's not such a bad thing either. And sometimes when people want to get into horses and have a limited amount of time, one horse is enough because if you can't give, if you don't have enough time to devote to more than that, then you're not really doing them or yourself any favors.
Yeah, got that.
Yeah. So that's what I think anyway. So John, based on your experience getting into horses and all that you've learned, what advice would you have for someone who's new to horses that really wants to get started and doesn't have any idea where to turn?
that's an excellent question as well. I think you want to go to a barn and ride some horses, make some friends, do whatever you have to do before you really spend any money on a horse. I had been around animals and I kind of related to animals. I knew that there was a way to talk to animals and have them respond. I just hadn't figured out what to do with horses. So for me, there was a little bit of an advantage there. If you're going to buy a horse, I went to somebody when I bought Jesse, and she had a number of different horses available. I researched what I wanted. I wanted a registered horse. I'd heard about the foundation section of the quarter horse breed, which sounded like a lot sturdier horse and was going to have fewer medical problems because getting off of Tex, I was focused on that. And then I rode that horse. I actually worked it three different times before I bought it. And the seller was very good with that. She didn't say, you can't do this with that horse, you can't do that with that horse. She says, do you mind if I watch? And I said, I use Clinton Anderson. She said, I don't know who he is. And I said, I got a stick and I got a string. And I said, I won't hurt your horse, but I want to see how it responds to my cues. And she sat there on the round pen and watched me for the 30 minutes that I worked that horse. And she said, I've been selling horses all my life. I've never seen anybody do that with the horse before they bought it. I said, they all want to get on them and ride them. And I said, well, I'll come back and do that again if you don't mind. And she said, not a problem. So I did that. And if there's one thing that's almost impossible for a new time horse owner to do, and I told myself I was going to do it, and I didn't. So do as I tell you, not as I did, and is to ride 10 horses before you buy one. I got to number 2, and I said, okay, this is the horse I want. But to ride 10 different horses before you write that check, I think that would really benefit you in the long run. And then once you have that horse, if you have no basic horse knowledge, get some. If you have the mindset that you can learn off of a book or off of a DVD or off of a TV series, then do it. But start from whoever's program from the beginning and go to the end. It's like learning to bake a cake. If you said, geez, I really don't have any eggs, but I'm going to make this cake even though the recipe calls for some, you're not going to get a very good cake. So you've got to use all the ingredients that whatever that trainer tells you to do, you've got to be willing to trust him and do it. And if you don't have that going in, then I'd seriously look at getting the horse in the first place, because it's not going to be a good outcome. Horses are 1,200 pounds. They can hurt you in a second, and the hurt can last for a very, very long time. So take that part into consideration. They're not a puppy and they're not a kitten, so they can really do some damage, and you have to take it very seriously. You own it. You owe it to the horse to take that responsibility and be a good leader.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And it is a great idea to go out and ride 10 horses before you buy one. And you are right. Most people won't do it because it takes a lot of time and because they tend to fall in love with one of the first ones that they look at. But my dad actually says the same thing. You know, you can always go back and buy that first horse if it ends up being the right one. But you should, you know, try several before you make that decision, because, you know, you have to find something that fits you and is going to work for you. And without having something to compare it to, it's awfully hard to know that, especially if you're not a horse person, you haven't ridden very many horses and you don't really know what a good one feels like. I always recommend if someone's going to get into horses, they need to get an older horse, you know, not some young horse that you're going to learn together with. I just,
right.
green on green equals black and blue. So new riders are going to have a lot better experience with an older horse that can kind of take care of them a little bit for the most part. And that they're not going to get hurt on. And that's my biggest thing. I don't want to see anybody get hurt and then never want to ride again.
Exactly.
You know, I want people to get into horses and be horse people for life, because it's an amazing experience. And a lot of people are horse people for life, but some that have bad wrecks, it really turns them off, or they get really badly hurt. And I just don't want to see anything like that happen.
And anyone who's been around horses, I'm sure you've gone through this as well, is when you do have a wreck with a horse or a scary moment, it shakes your confidence for a while. And it takes a while for that confidence to come back.
Yep, that's for sure. And some people never really get it back. And some people are just scared of horses from the get-go, you know.
Yes.
Before they ever get on one, they think they would like to ride, but they just are scared to death of horses in general. So got to get the right one for sure.
And that's easier said than done quite often.
Because, it is.
Because there's financial considerations and there's also housing considerations. Hay is very high here in California because of the drought. So you have to be able to weather all the storms. Learning about the dental care horses need and the farrier care every 6 to 8 weeks that they need. You know, those are all things to consider when you go out and make that initial purchase, because they're very important to the horse.
Well, yeah, and they're expensive, and I think sometimes people don't realize that it's not. I have this thing about the free horse, like, oh, there's a free horse on Craigslist or whatever. I'm going to go get that free horse, or I'm going to go get a rescue horse or whatever. And what people don't realize a lot of times is that the purchase price is the cheapest investment you're going to make for your horse. You know, go out and spend a few thousand dollars on a horse that's going to be safe, and realize that whether you get a free horse or one that you spend a little money for, they still cost the same to feed and shoe and vet bills, and, you know, all of that stuff costs the same regardless. So
that's an excellent point.
And you might, and you're better off feeding a good one than, you know, one that you can't, that you won't ride because you're scared of it.
That's right. Yeah, too many horses are locked in their box stall and not let out just because the owners, they can't sell them and they can't ride them. And that's a real shame. I hate seeing that.
It is. So definitely taking your time and making sure you make the right decision when you make that initial purchase is really important. And I think for most people, it's probably a good idea to have some help, someone who has experience that can sort of guide you through that process.
Yes, your friend was quite lucky to have you to go out and ride that Friesian so that she could see and you could tell, you could give your feedback on that horse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was happy to do that because I don't want to see my friends buy something that's going to be a bad investment for them and something that they're not going to be able to have fun with, because that's just a waste of money and they're not going to be happy, and then it's going to end up becoming someone else's problem.
Yes.
And I don't like to see that either.
Pass one problem down the line to somebody else, right?
Yeah, I'm not an advocate for doing that at all. And unfortunately, that happens a lot. And people will go to a horse sale and buy something that comes through cheap, and then they get it home and realize why it was cheap.
That's a bad feeling when you.
It is. And sadly, I've been that person that's bought a cheap horse at a horse sale and realized when I got home why it was so cheap. But I'm also not going to take the horse back to the sale and perpetuate that problem and tell somebody that it's a good horse when it's not, because I just don't believe that that's ethical, and it's, you know, it gives me a bad name that I'm somebody that'll go sell you a horse that's going to hurt you. I'm never going to knowingly do that to somebody.
Alyssa, am I to understand that you're saying that not every horse at the horse sale is a snowman? That famous horse for $80 turned into a great jumper?
Or, Christy Peterson and Bozo. She bought that horse from the circus for like $800 and won the world on it, the NFR. No, definitely not. I mean, and sometimes, you know,
Darn. There's
probably problem horses that could be fixed if somebody bought them and had the time to spend and knew what they were doing, but most people don't and won't. And so, you know, that's my dad's theory on horse sales, is that if you're going to buy a horse, at least for him, he won't buy anything that's not a colt, because he figures, you know, if he's starting fresh, then if that horse has any problems, he created them. But he's not going to buy something that has problems that someone else created.
He likes that tabula rasa, that clean slate, so that
exactly
no history.
Yep, exactly, and no holes. You know, if it's a 2-year-old that hasn't been started or has just barely been started, then you're probably not going to have a lot of problems you have to fix.
When he, you know, it's always amazed me is that a guy like your dad can look at a colt and determine what's he looking at? What is he seeing in that horse? Is it the way it moves? Is it the way his ears move? His nose flares? What? I mean, I don't understand. To me, it's hieroglyphics. I can't see anything from a young colt pretty much.
Well, I think that for him, because he's looking for horses for a certain discipline. I mean, he's primarily a cutting horse trainer. So I think first and foremost, he looks at the breeding, and then he looks at like kind of the resaleability of a horse. Like, is it pretty? Is someone else going to want to buy this horse once I have it trained? You know, he looks at a lot of those types of things. And then confirmation, of course, is important, because if the confirmation's not there, they're not going to hold up to the training and the competition and all of that. So, and I think one of the most important things, which is kind of a weird thing that you sort of just learn to read once you've been around horses a lot, is the eye. I mean, so many people will say you got to look in a horse's eye and to determine their personality.
Right.
You can look at a horse and tell if they have a kind eye or not. And it's pretty evident once you've been around them a lot to tell the difference between a kind eye and a freaked out eye.
Oh, goodness.
So, and then, you know, I hear a lot about the swirls too, which I don't know a whole lot about the swirls myself, but I know that if they have one swirl in the center of their forehead, that's supposed to be good.
Oh, good. Jesse has one swirl.
If they have like multiple swirls or they're not in the center of their forehead, then that's bad, I guess. So I'm not an expert on swirls, but there are people out there who are.
And I've heard people look at the forehead, whether it's convex or concave too. And
yeah, I don't know much about that one either, but there's a lot of voodoo out there. Yeah. Some of it has merit and some of it probably doesn't, but I think the most important thing is just making sure you take your time.
It's like trying to buy a used car and deciding whether how good a car is going to be by the rims that the guy put on it or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, John, I really appreciate you being on the podcast today. Where can people find you if they want to check your podcast out?
My podcast is the Woe Podcast, and it's spelled just like it sounds. It's that thing you want to do when you want the horse to stop. You yell "Whoa!" and we want people to stop by. So that's how that connection goes. And it's woepodcast.com. We're on iTunes and Stitcher as well. You can find us on Facebook under Woe Podcast, and I also tweet and Instagram, and then my personal website is johnherrer.com, and my last name is spelled H-A-R-R-E-R, and I do photography and freelance writing as well, and my portfolio and such is on my personal website. And then I try to keep the Woe Podcast site just to horses and the things that I do with horses. One thing that people might be interested in is I did chronicle our path through the Clinton Anderson Method on YouTube, and I have a YouTube channel. It's listed under John Hare, and you can find all the trials and tribulations of my life with horses on that, as well as with videos about my dogs and cats, as I've included those there.
Awesome. Well, I'll provide links to those sites in the
Thank
show
you.
Notes so people can check you out and check out the Woe Podcast. And I think, you know, people who are new to horses, I'm sure will get a lot of benefit out of your YouTube videos as well, and seeing how you've applied what you've learned.
So I hope so.
Very cool. So I just have one final question for you, John. It's the question I ask all of my guests at the end of each episode, and that is, what do you think is the most important quality for any good cowboy or horseman to have?
I think that of the cowboys that I know, one of the things that I've respected most, the characteristics that I see, is the willingness to get the job done no matter what. Cowboys, you know, they're out there moving cows or doctoring cows or doing whatever it is. They have to figure out how to get that job complete. And their ingenuity and their stubbornness is just just amazes me. And the ones I respect the most are those guys that go out there and they might be out in the middle of nowhere all by themselves and they've got a job to do and they figure out a way to get it done. So that's the characteristic I think is most important in a cowboy.
That's a good one and probably important for anybody to have that stick-to-itiveness, I guess. And I can attest to the fact that cowboys can be very stubborn. I'm not going to name any names like, you know, the guy who raised me or anything right. like that. But based on my own experience, I would say that stubbornness is a pretty common quality to find.
And I do hope you'll come on my show. But I want to ask you, as podcaster to podcaster, I want to ask you one question.
Okay, John.
First of all, it's been interesting being on the other side of the interview, and it's been a lot of fun. I can now see what my guests go through, and that's very insightful. But you said you got into podcasting because you love listening to podcasts, and I'd like you to give me two or three of your favorite podcasts that you like to listen to.
Oh, goodness. It's hard to narrow it down to two or three. But I would say originally I got into listening to podcasting because I liked listening to business podcasts. And I still listen to a lot of those. But I guess I do listen to some different genres as well now. So I listen to the Woe podcast, of course, and the one that PRS is doing now. It's called Masters of the Ride. That's another rodeo type podcast. And then Pat Flynn's Smart Passive Income is one of my favorites.
Cool.
And the Model Health Show is another good one that I listen to.
Health. I have to explore that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I have many. I probably have about 30 that I subscribe to. But yeah.
It's hard to keep up with them all.
It is. It is. There's a lot of different ones to listen to for sure. Well, thank you so much, John. I really appreciate you coming on today. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you so much, Alyssa. I appreciate you inviting me.
Yes, absolutely.
We'll do it again on my side of the podcast.
Sounds good.
I look forward to that.
Me too.
I hope you enjoyed that episode with John Herrer of the Woe podcast. As always, you can find links to his website and his social media channels in the show notes. We talked a lot about pointers for buying your first horse and getting started with horses. So if you have any questions for me beyond what we covered in the show, I would love for you to get in touch with me. You can go to earnyourspurs.com and send me an email. You can also click on the Cowboy Q&A tab. I am going to be starting a new podcast probably after the first of the year that just answers your questions. So if you go to earnyourspurs.com, click on the Cowboy Q&A tab, you can leave me a voicemail right there on the website with any questions that you have regarding anything related to cowboy culture or horses, anything that you want to know. And if I pick your question, then it will be in a future episode of the Cowboy Q&A podcast. I can't believe the NFR is coming up in just a little over 2 weeks. I'm really excited to be down there, and I'm hoping to see some of you. So I haven't worked out the details yet, but I'm planning to be at Cowboy Christmas at the NFR Fan Zone at some point while I'm there. So when I figure that out, I will post it on the website and let you know so you can come and say hi. I will also have more Earn Your Spurs stickers on hand at the UNLV Rodeo booth. So if you're going to be down there, send me an email or send me a message on Facebook or tweet to me. However you want to reach out, I would love to know if you're coming and I would sure love to meet you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I so appreciate those of you who've been leaving me reviews in iTunes. It's awesome. And I just don't know what I would do without you guys. So thanks for listening and we'll see you next week.
For listening to the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Until next time, happy trails and spur on.